Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is The Tech Guy with Leo Laporte, episode 744 for Sunday, February 13th, 2011. Enjoy.
Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and it's time to talk about computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, all that stuff. The list gets longer all the time. Everything's got a chip in it these days. Digital photography, surround sound. I saw an amazing demonstration. This is a perfect example of how chips are changing everything. When I was at CES a couple of weeks ago, and I hope you heard our CES shows. If you didn't, they're available in podcast form. On my TWiT podcast network at twit.tv. It's in the specials feed, actually, but there's also the radio shows are there as well. Actually, they're on Tech Guy Labs, too, our radio show site. It's all available. But anyway, it was the last thing, actually, I saw before I left Las Vegas on Sunday afternoon. Scott Wilkinson and I, we said, one last chance to kind of find something cool and new and different at CES. We'd seen all the 3D TVs. He'd gone over to see the high-end audio at the Venetian. You know, I'm less interested in high-end audio. I'm less interested, I guess, from a theoretical point of view, but I'm not going to spend $20,000 on a pair of speakers. And I don't know very many people who will. That's a hardcore enthusiast, not a normal you and me. He said, you know, I heard there was something in surround sound that was kind of interesting, and I'd like to go see it. And I said, oh, you mean the Hire? And he said, yes. And I said, well, let's go. There's a Swiss company called, I think it's Sonic Emotion. And they make a chip. They don't make speakers. They make a chip which they sell to speaker manufacturers that take a stereo two-speaker system or maybe a six-speaker. You know, now they have these sound bars sometimes you can put in front of your TV. And they use digital, very sophisticated digital technology to take those basically stereo systems, they're in front of you left and right, and fill the room with surround sound, be able to play stuff behind you, above you, below you, you know, 30 degrees off-center and 15 degrees above the horizon, anywhere in this sphere that surrounds you. Call it the sound stage. And I'm always skeptical. We've seen a lot of sound bars in the past, and they're really a way for people who don't have the space or the money to do a, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 speaker system to kind of simulate it, I guess. I was a little skeptical, but I'd heard such good things from my friend Robert Herron, who is a home theater expert. Scott himself had heard really interesting reports about this. So we went over to the Sonic Emotion booth, and they had $100 Kobe speak. Now, Kobe, C-O-B-Y, if you know the name, is a really kind of a low-end audio-video company. They make very inexpensive cameras and stuff. You know, this kind of stuff you see at Target or Walgreens, you know, inexpensive stuff. They had a $100 soundbar. And then Hire, which is not next tier up, they're not the high-end audio, but they had a $350 soundbar. Small thing, wasn't much bigger than a clock radio. Sits in front of your TV. And in the booth, it was great. It was actually a great demo. They had a booth with a button, big red button. And if you walk up to the button and you press it, it goes to the stereo mode. It just turns off the Sonic Emotion chip, and the speakers are doing what they would do without any help from digital signal processing or any of the sophisticated electronics. And it sounds kind of, frankly, like tinny speakers right in front of me. You let go of the button, and whoom, the room fills. There's sound coming from all around you. It was mind-boggling. That was $350. So I went around the corner. Okay, well, how does this do with the Kobe? That's $100. Same thing. Unbelievable. It went from tinny stereo to surround sound. Now, I imagine, Scott was impressed, and he knows his home theater. I imagine somebody who's like a home theater aficionado would say, oh, Leo,
Oh, please, Leah, don't call that surround sound. That's not surround. But I was very impressed.
Kobe's selling theirs right now. Haier's going to sell theirs in a few months. And this Swiss company, Sonic Emotion, is going to be selling their chip to other companies. And if, you know, as you get higher end and you put them in, say, let's say a Polk audio soundbar with really nice speakers, this is a really great thing. It is just gives you, I was very impressed. But the reason I bring it up is this is an example of how chips change everything. The chips they're selling are digital signal processors. They work with analog signals, but it's still a computer brain taking information, and in real time, it has to do it very quickly, obviously, making such major transformations that it changes everything. Chips change everything, and it just blew me away. So that's really what this show is about: is how things change when you move to the digital domain, what you can do with them. Just think about your vinyl records. Some of you will remember those. You know, if you wanted to duplicate it, you would dub it to a tape. And every time you made a copy of that tape, it would sound worse and worse and worse and worse. In fact, every time you played the vinyl record, it would sound worse and worse and worse and worse. As soon as we were able to take this audio, this analog audio, these little wiggly waveforms, and turn them into ones and zeros, that stopped, right? Now, maybe there was a little bit of degradation in the digitizing process, the getting from the little wiggly waves to ones and zeros. And it's true. There's a little bit, mostly inaudible. In fact, in my opinion, at least for people like us, unless you have golden ears, completely inaudible. Only theoretically do you know that there's stuff missing. I mean, it's pretty good. But once you make it ones and zeros now, what can you do? Well, you can transmit it at the speed of light. Couldn't do that with vinyl. You can make infinite perfect copies. Couldn't do that with vinyl, much to the chagrin of the record companies. You can modify it. You can edit it easily. You can mash it up with other music easily. That's why all of a sudden in the 80s and 90s, as computers came along, we started to see more and more of these mashups where people would take songs, match beats, do some interesting stuff. Once they're bits, the sky's the limit. So that's what this show is about. Phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO. If you want to ask a question, make a comment, make a suggestion, tell me about something cool you saw. Tell me about something neat going on in your life, some great idea you've had. When we were also at CES, we talked to the guy who invented VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet program. He created the idea of a spreadsheet program, Bob Frankston. And he says it's time to take back the internet. He said that the phone companies and the cable companies have no interest in giving us the internet we deserve. Of course they don't. Why would they? Their chief interest is making as much money as they can off the existing infrastructure. But he says there's an interesting problem here for them, especially for the cable companies. They see their business dissolving in front of their eyes. Why do you think Comcast just bought NBC? Because they want to get in the content business. Comcast had divested all their, you know, they had Liberty Media. They had a big content division, which they got rid of in the 90s because they didn't want to be in content. They thought, oh, the money will be in the cable. And 1,000 content providers will compete for access to our customers. Well, the internet changed all that, didn't it? And now it's the people who make the stuff that are in the driver's seat because there's 1,000 ways to deliver it all via the internet. Comcast realizes it can't make as much money as an internet company selling wholesale bits as it can as a cable company selling premium content. So Bob says this is an opportunity for us to take back the internet. Take back that old copper they don't want anymore. They're getting out of the copper business. Maybe we can do something with it. We don't have the same, maybe community internet or even apartment building internet or neighborhood internet. Those are the ideas I love to hear about. 8888-ASK-LEO. Some big changes this week. We'll talk about Steve Jobs stepping down. We'll talk about Eric Schmidt stepping down. I think he was fired at Google. What really happened at Google? We'll talk about that. Big shakeup at Hewlett-Packard and their board of directors. This was an interesting week for these big computer companies. And of course, Keith Olbermann got fired, but that's another story. Although, you know, it might not be another story. It does seem a little coincidental that this happened right at the time that was it Jeff Zucker, the president of NBC, leaves, Comcast takes over. That's in. No, Comcast says, no, we're not. No, we wouldn't do that. Yeah, this could all be part and parcel of the same thing. Let's talk about it. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Now we have some more calls. Let's get back to the phones. Joe is in Corona, California. Hey, Joe, Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. I need some advice on a good portable, like a receipt scanner. My wife's got a terrible habit of saving receipts for anything and everything.
You just want to get rid of them, don't you?
And I'm trying to find a good portable scanner that I can even use on my desktop, perhaps. Something that's got good software, good resolution, and I can print off of it. And I know there's so many scanners out there, and it's kind of confusing for me. I know there's Xerox, Bullet Scan, Road Warrior, Iris.
I'll tell you my favorite. I haven't tried them all, so they may all be good. I don't know. But the one I use and I like and I have in our office is Neat Receipts.
Okay.
From Neatco, NEATCO.com. They make a number of different form factors, including one that's so small it just sits right behind your keyboard.
Uh-huh.
And you just power the thing right through there, and it's a great way, and it's got great software that will that knows about receipts, will interpret the receipt as a receipt, uh-huh. and even do the math and so forth. It's just fantastic. The Neatwork software and the Neat Receipt Scanner, I think, are a very good bundle. I'm very happy with them. You know, nowadays, a lot of cell phones have built-in scanners. In fact, they have good cameras, let's put it that way, that can work as scanners.
Right.
And there are even websites like Expenser and others that will take photos from your cell phone as a receipt and turn it into a receipt. So it kind of depends what you want to do. But, for going forward, you might want to look at XPENSER.com. You can basically, as you get a receipt, this is what another way to do it. You take a picture of it with your cell phone and mm-hmm. mail it to Expenser, and it saves it, interprets it. And makes an expense report out of it. So if it's expense reports you want, I know it's really we're in an interesting era, frankly, for this stuff.
Okay,
but I like Neat Receipts. If you've got what you have is shoebox full of stuff that you want to get rid of, that's the way to do it.
Okay, and can I print color or black and white off Neat Receipts or?
Yep. Once you scan it, it's a regular scan.
Okay. Great.
And Dan in our chat room and a number of others are also recommending the Fujitsu Scan Snap.
Fujitsu.
Fujitsu, Fujitsu, well-known Japanese firm. They make something called the Scan Snap.
Scan Snap, okay.
Yep. Expensify is another, like Expenser, is another website, expensify.com that will also do it.
Okay.
I have to say Neat Receipts is great, and apparently Amazon's having a sale on it right now, so that's the one I've been using.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Leo. I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure, Joe. Yeah, it's nice to get rid of those shoe boxes. It really is. Even if you never use them, at least it's done. And there's some other recommendations. Oh, and I shouldn't forget this one. And thank you, Rick5 in the chat room. I completely forgot about Shoeboxed. If you're lazy and you want all this stuff saved, but you don't want to do it yourself, Shoeboxed.com. You put everything in a box and you send it to them. And they do it. Let them do the work. There are a number of services like this where why should you be sitting there going scan, scan, scan? And I don't know where they send it to prisoners. I don't know. They for all I know, they sent it to India. But somewhere they found people who will cheaply scan your stuff in and then send you the data. So that might be the good solution if you've got a ton of stuff and you just want to get it out of the way. Or, you know, you're sitting there, you listen to the tech guy show, and you just go, nyeh, nyeh, nyeh. Neat Receipts will do it about that fast. Nyeh, nyeh. It sounds just like that, too. Nyeh, nyeh, nyeh. Andrew, Boise, Idaho, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how you doing?
I am very well. Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Well, I've got some old electric sheet metal presses. One was written on Visual Basic 6 in ME 2000, and I am doing two things. I want to add some features to it, and I need to have some things called .ocx files. Unfortunately, most of the ones I have are obsolete. The companies don't exist anymore. How do I go about finding this stuff?
So you have software and you have, are these hardware?
Well, no, these are, I think they call them ActiveX files.
Okay, so you have some files.
Yeah, I have several ActiveX files that I need licenses for. So when I load this on my developer's machine, it won't run until I obtain these licenses. And this stuff was written in 2000, 98 or 2000, and many of these companies no longer exist. They've been bought. I've been checking for weeks on yes. the internet trying
basically, to... Basically, I'm thinking these OCX files are scanned optical character recognition files.
Well, actually not. The one's called...
No?
32x10.ocx is called Button Maker. So this is it's got a visual.
Okay. So OCX was used for a number. You know, file extensions aren't necessarily unique. So OCX in this case is an Olay object. Oh boy. So it was kind of, you're right. It was a program, but it's not a program that can run by itself.
Correct.
It has to be, it's a custom control that goes in a Visual Basic app.
Exactly.
XP9, okay, I'm hoping XP99 is right here because this is a good solution. He says you can change the settings for ActiveX. You're going to run it with Internet Explorer. You know, in other words, you're going to open them with Internet Explorer. He says you can change the settings for ActiveX and Internet Explorer to allow them to run without requiring licenses. I presume you're running them and it says, where's the license?
Exactly, right.
Yeah. According to XP99, who happens to be a very knowledgeable Windows guy in our chat room, he says it's an IE setting that you can change that will say, you know, say stop, you don't need a license anymore. That would allow you to run them. I don't think you can modify them because, of course, you have to have the source code to modify them.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's just been a real pain to try and find those.
I bet it has. Yeah, I bet it has. But I think XP99's got the right idea. He says, look for a setting that it lowers your security setting.
Sure. Sure.
And that's a risky thing to do if these are the files are of unknown provenance because OCX files are really programs, so you're running a program, but you know where they came from. You know they're safe, and you just want to have them run.
Right, right. Then the other thing is there any way for me to go copy this disk drive? I think they used to call it Mirror, and if this drive ever dies, be able to plug in another one and just be up and running?
Kind of depends how the mirror was made. Mirroring is a RAID technique. RAID stands for Redundant Array of Independent or Intelligent Disks. And the idea of RAID is you use multiple drives for one of two purposes. One for data redundancy, which is how yours were used, and the other is for speed. In this case...
I don't have an array or anything.
Well, the mirror, was it made by a RAID array, or you're just saying...
I'm just saying the word mirror. I don't know.
Ah, you're colloquially using the word mirror. So it is a duplicate drive.
Yeah, I would like to make a duplicate drive. How do I go...
I see. Oh, okay. Yeah, there's all sorts of programs that will clone it. There's a free one that I like a lot called Clonezilla. It's an open source program, Clonezilla. And it'll allow you to clone that drive bit for bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme, for high-speed internet. at the lowest price ever, $14.95 a month. Call 866 the number 2 GetNet to get DSL Extreme. Would I lie to you? 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. That's the number Jan called. Dogs and Cats 101. And after the hutch, I almost said inside the hutch, after the hutch dot info. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
So I answered your non-question. Now, what's your real question?
I'm going to China, to Beijing in October to work with the pandas.
Oh, man. Jan, you got a great life.
Well, sort of. Now,
can you train a panda? I mean, I know you're an expert dog trainer. Can you train a panda?
No, it's a thing where they let you go there and go in and work with the pandas and spend a week in Beijing.
Have you been to China before?
No. Am I going to
My son Henry and I went there last summer. You're going to love it.
That's why I was calling, because I have an iPhone 4, I have an iPad. I mean, what do I bring?
I would certainly bring any. Well, first of all, the hotel you're in will almost, if it's a decent hotel, unless you're staying in the Hutong, if you're staying in a hotel, we'll have Wi-Fi. And so I used my iPhone, and I didn't have an iPad at the time, but and my laptop with the Wi-Fi. Great. In fact, I was able to use the Wi-Fi there to Skype home and save myself a lot of money.
Really?
Yeah. Now, the rules change all the time in China, and they may be blocking Skype that day. When I got there, for instance, this was July 2009, I could use Twitter. I could use Facebook. By the time I left 10 days later, I couldn't use either.
And with my phone, so I don't get a lot of expensive phones.
Yes, you want to call AT&T, and you want to buy an international data plan. And by the way, the cost, if you don't, the cost of data roaming, you know, if you use the Chinese phone company's data, is sky high, thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So it's roughly $1 a megabyte. You call. I'm going to do this too because I'm going to South America in a couple of weeks, and I'll call them and I'll say I want the. Now you got to figure out you're going to be there a week. You got to kind of monitor your usage really closely. 100 megabytes is probably enough. That's about $100.
Right. And what about using like Google Voice? Go to my Gmail. You know how you do that?
Anything you do online. Google Voice, Twitter, Facebook, checking email, all of that uses international data at a very high price. So your 100 megabytes is your pool, and that's up and down. So if you decide... This is what really ends up costing me. I upload pictures, audio, movies. Man, that ends up costing a lot.
Wow.
So it both directions you're paying for it. So now there is a usage app on the iPhone, but don't believe it. I did, and I got dinged heavy when I got back. I called AT&T. So you could turn that international plan off. How much did I spend? It was double the amount that the iPhone said. So there's an AT&T wireless app which you want to put on there and use that. They say that's accurate. No, I don't know about that. The problem is really that there's a lag between the time you use the data and the time the Chinese telecoms notify AT&T. And so, I don't know. You'd think the phone would know exactly how many bits are going in and out, but apparently it doesn't.
Right. Okay. Well, and I have an 11-inch Air, but I'm afraid to take that. You know?
It's fine to bring it because you'll only be able to use that with Wi-Fi. So in the hotel there's Wi-Fi. So what you want to do is whenever possible use the Wi-Fi. That's much less expensive.
Oh right. And I can do that also with my iPad.
With the iPad, the iPhone, and the Air, all can use Wi-Fi. It's the 3G data that gets you in trouble, and this is true all over the world. Call your phone company and say, what is the cost of roaming data? And they will tell you. And it's a lot more expensive than using it at home. So you have, in AT&T's case, they do have an international data plan, which is still expensive, much more, $1 a megabyte. It's ridiculous. But it's a lot less than it'll cost. And if you go over, they start charging you at the full rate.
Great. And I hope they speak a lot of English.
They do. The English is something that the Chinese really want to learn because they want to play in the international economic scene.
Nice.
You're going to love it. Eat food like crazy. Be careful where you eat. Eat in fancy restaurants if you can.
Yeah.
You know, John C. Dvorak, my good friend, the computer and wine expert, told me about a Peking duck place. He said, but you don't want to go in the daytime because it's too disgusting. You have to go when it's dark so you can't see. And I asked our guide, I said, well, this is where he says the best Peking duck in Beijing is. And the guide said, yeah, but I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, I eat there, but I'm used to it now. So we went to, believe it or not, the Hyatt in Beijing and had an amazing Peking duck. It's interesting because I have this notion of China being an agrarian nation, communist. There is an absolute wealthy elite in China, and there are a lot of very expensive. There's a fancy restaurant designed by Philippe Starck. It's amazing. I mean, it's incredible. I don't know, who's going there. The Plutarchs, I guess, or whatever, plutocrats. But somebody's going there, and it's worth it if you can to go to some nice restaurants because you will never have better food. I mean, Chinese invented haute cuisine.
Not dogs.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you like Chinese food, but it's not like we get in America. Let me put it this way. It is very good.
Yeah.
And the culture, and it's fascinating, and the smog is appalling, and it might not be so bad in October, but it was it reminded me of the, they talked about the London fogs of the early 19th century. It's like that. At first you think it's weather, then you realize, wait a minute, this isn't weather. This is the air. It's thick.
Right. Well, I'll let you know how it goes.
Have a great time. I think it is absolutely the most interesting country in the world right now.
Great. All right, thanks.
And you're getting to see the pandas. I'm so jealous. What fun. Thank you, Jan. Jay in Providence, North Carolina. Hi, Jay. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo, I've got a short but two-part question for you. How do you feel about the practice of websites selling aggregate user data? And if you do feel kind of good about it, what would be a good way to go about doing that if you get a website?
Well, they all do it, first of all. If you this is how Facebook makes money. This is how Google makes money. They don't sell individual data. At least we don't know, but we don't think. They claim they don't sell individual data. Actually, I'll tell you a story that'll raise the hair on the back of your neck in a little bit. But in theory, they only sell aggregate data. So they say, you want 25 to 50-year-olds who live in the Northwest? We can sell that. We don't tell you their names, but we can make sure they see the ads. As an individual, it's not so easy to do. Is somebody approaching you about doing that?
No. I'm considering putting together a website. I've got the domain name registered. In fact, I've actually got several registered, but it's one of those things I feel like if I can make money, more money than...
Yeah, the way to do it is not, there's no broker who's going to say, yeah, tell us everything about your users. But if you put Google Ads on there, and that's what people do. They use AdSense. That is the webmaster's version of Google AdWords. It's very easy to do. You can do it in 3 seconds. If you go to Google and I guess google.com/AdSense, set up an account. You won't make a huge amount of money, but you make some money. It depends on the number of people who visit your site. In effect, you're selling Google aggregate visitor data because those ads embedded on your page report back to Google who's visiting. You don't know a lot about your users. If you collect information more than just the fact that they're visiting, if you collect email addresses and so forth, you've got to be very clear. If you plan to sell that stuff, you've got to be very clear. That is wrong. I know sites do it. It's wrong to share email addresses or any other information that you collect. You'll know one thing about everybody who visits your site. That's their IP address, which roughly pinpoints them. You could set a cookie on their browser that will then identify them uniquely. This is what Google does. This is what most everybody does. What I don't like is sites that aggregate information, from forms and things. My email address, my age, my income. And then sell it to other sites which aggregate further information. Pretty soon, you're a consumer with a target on your back walking around. Not fond of that. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte.
The tech guy.
Like this music. Website is techguylabs.com. This is episode 737. Ben's on the line from Minneapolis, Minnesota. You have a Windows phone, Ben?
Hey, Leo. Yeah, I don't know if you remember me. I called a little while, about a month or so ago. I'm blind. I was asking you about what is the best phone to get for persons with disabilities.
And I said the iPhone.
Well, yes, you did. And I was a little apprehensive about that. And I think more and more, as I've looked into it, I've got a bit of news. I actually got a hold of some AT&T product development people. They got me in touch with some Samsung development people and some LG development people, but none of them had any answers to questions as to how the best to serve my needs. Finally got the president phone number for Microsoft, who developed.
Wow. You know, Microsoft, I met a woman this summer who had, Microsoft hired an accessibility expert whose job was to make sure accessibility was built into every Microsoft product. Her portfolio was completely across all the product line. So they do, you're right, they are very aware of this, and they do want to make sure that their stuff is accessible. So what did they say?
Well, I haven't actually gotten back with anybody yet. I am still working in process. It's taken me a while just to get this footwork done.
Yeah. I'm glad you're an activist on this, though, Ben. Because what you're doing is helping everybody.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
As not just for me as a person with disability, but the whole tech industry, because it just makes life so much easier. Because it's going to come down to the day where you walk into your house and you talk to your computer.
Well, to be honest, a lot of the technologies we use, especially in phones, come from things that were developed for accessibility originally. But including on-screen keyboards, Zoom Pinch, a lot of things that we have taken for granted came from the accessibility department. So you're absolutely right. Improving accessibility does improve it for everybody. So what did Microsoft tell you?
You got it. And I just want to say, I listen to it all the time. I love your network. And you're absolutely right. A lot of things do get taken from the disability side of things, but a lot of it does come from the science fiction end of it, too. I know you're a big proponent of Audible. If I could recommend a book to you, The Unincorporated Man.
The Unincorporated Man.
It's a great read. I'm sure you will find it fascinating and a foretelling of the future of just a whole lot of things.
Who wrote it?
Microsoft, they've really wanted to keep me steered in the direction of their phones, but come to find out, a lot of the memory cards don't work with Windows phones.
In fact, Microsoft and the manufacturers, when I bought my Windows 7 Samsung Focus, Windows Phone 7 Samsung Focus, the AT&T guy, and this was on launch day, told me, he said, we got a bulletin, do not put an SD card in it. And Microsoft said that they would fix this. They haven't yet. It's unclear. Now, if you listen to my podcast, Ben, and I take it you do, then you might listen to Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott is very much all over this. He's our Windows guy and an expert. He wrote the book Windows Phone Secrets. He believes that this issue comes from the fact that Windows Phone most phones that have SD cards use them as an extra disk. That's all. You know, when I plug in my phone, it shows up as a disk. I can copy stuff over it. It can look at it. Windows Phone 7 uses it as an integral part of the operating system. So Paul says, if the card is not good enough or fast enough, it can actually break the phone. The phone will stop working. So what Microsoft has realized is that not all SD cards, and these are the micro SD, not all micro SD cards are made alike. That some big name manufacturers' cards will not work with Windows Phone 7 because they're not reliable or fast enough. And so what they need to do is a certification program. What they're hoping to do is a certified for Windows Phone 7. But so far, nothing has happened. Paul has become greatly disillusioned, by the way, with Microsoft. They promised updates to the phone by now. Nothing's happened. They're now backing down on that. It is kind of a mess, unfortunately. And to my knowledge, the advisory still being given out by AT&T and T-Mobile is you may not put an SD card in your phone. Just don't. Now, I know a lot of people who have and haven't had problems. So if you're willing to spend money to try cards, please do. But as for now, it's not recommended by the companies that make these phones or by Microsoft. And I hope to have an update on that for you at some point in the future. But that's how it is right now. It's a shame. Hey, before we go on, and we got to thank you for the call, Ben. It's great to talk to you. I want to talk to John in Santa Monica a little bit about Skype. But before we go on, I want to talk about a brand new product from the folks who make Nod 32, ESET. You know about ESET and Nod 32. I recommend it all the time as the best antivirus for Windows. Well, now cybersecurity for the Mac is here from ESET. ESET's world-famous lightweight computer protection is now on the Mac, and they made a very Mac-ish, very nice version of it. You can get it at Apple stores nationwide, also Micro Center and Fry's. Of course, as always, it proactively detects bad things as they happen before they hit you. But they also include in ESET Cybersecurity for the Mac, a brand new free educational component. And I think education, what your behavior is so important to protecting yourself online. This is a great, I think all security products should do it. But right now it's Nod 32 and Cybersecurity for the Mac. You can try it free for 30 days. Go to eset.com/Mac. For a free test drive, eset.com/Mac. For years, I've been saying, if you use Windows, you need Nod 32. Now I can say it. If you use Macintosh, you need ESET cybersecurity for the Mac. Try it free right now at eset.com/Mac. We lost that call. I was going to talk about Skype. Well, let's go to Tom then in Thousand Oaks. Tom, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I have a couple of questions to ask you. But first, we really enjoy listening to your show. We've learned a lot.
Thanks.
From it.
Thank you.
My wife and I, about a month ago, bought a HD TV and a Blu-ray player. We really like it.
Isn't it great? And I really think that buying the Blu-ray player is what brings it to life, because then you see what it's capable of.
Well, that's part of my question. It's a Sony ES. It's a new one. I hooked up the wireless portion to it, so to run it off my G modem here. But I'm thinking of running a LAN connection to it, running Cat 6.
And you're speaking of when you want to, say, stream Netflix movies or things like that.
Right. And this is a direct
internet content. And what, by the way, this is one of the great things now that's happening with Blu-ray players. They have an Ethernet port, they have Wi-Fi, and now you can pull in internet content like your Netflix movies, streaming movies, right through them. And I think that's great.
Well, here's my question. I'm running DSL. My speed's running about 2.8 meg, and I'm wondering if that's really fast enough to be streaming HD movies.
Oh, yeah. Nominally, it is.
Yeah.
And this is what happens. First of all, Wi-Fi might slow that down or right. make it less consistent. So plugging it in hardwired, if you're having problems, could very well be the difference. The other problem is sometimes internet access, especially slower internet access, is inconsistent. So it might be 2.8 when you measure it and then 1.0 every once in a while. And the problem is that's not fast enough. So it's low enough that you might have issues, especially if other people are using the internet at the same time.
Right.
So you want to, if it's just you and your wife and you're not using the internet, it should be plenty.
Well, down the road, probably within a year or so, Verizon's going to put Fios in here and I'll probably hook up to their data.
Then you'll be great. Yeah. Have you noticed a problem or are you just worried about it?
No, I haven't. You know, we downloaded, we watched some YouTube stuff on there, which is low resolution.
Yeah, YouTube actually is worse than Netflix. Netflix does a lot of very smart stuff about buffering, about slowing itself down, you know, lowering the quality if it's not a. It's actually very smart and can work in a lot. I use it in Wi-Fi, and it works fine. Every once in a while, we'll get buffering.
Is the buffering done at the Netflix end, or is it done at the Blu-ray player?
It's Netflix.
Okay. Well, then you've answered my question. I'll go ahead.
Yeah.
Running at my hardwire over there.
Certainly, if you're having problems, you might find that Wi-Fi is plenty. I would try it with Wi-Fi, but if you're having problems, going hardwired will definitely make a difference. It's always faster than Wi-Fi and more consistent.
Well, then one follow-up question. It's a short one. Would you recommend? I'm running a wireless G. Would you recommend wireless N router? Then.
Well, since you haven't had any problems yet, I would just try it and see.
All right.
And then N would be better. Hardwired would be best still. But you know what? Try it with G, Tom. It might work great. Hey, thanks for the call. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More to come right after this. Good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and we're going to get back to the phones in just a little bit. I was reading an interesting article, and I thought I'd pass this along. It's not breaking news. In fact, it's a blog post on the, I love the name of this blog, the Slight Paranoia blog. Christopher Segoyan writes it. It's a security and privacy analysis. He posted this a couple of years ago, December 2009, but I found it the other day, and I found it, frankly, surprising. In fact, I'm really surprised that it isn't better known. Have you ever heard of a pen register? Pen register is essentially a kind of government surveillance. We all know about wiretapping. Wiretapping is severely regulated. You have to get a court order. Not an easy thing to do. And every year, the U.S. courts produce a wiretap report, which details every intercept order requested by all law enforcement, federal, state, and local, during that year. And, you know, they can keep track of this because, of course, you need a warrant before anyone can tap a phone or intercept an internet connection. That's important. Or place a bug in your house. They have to get a permit, in effect, to get a judge to approve it. And there has to be evidence to do it. You can't just say, I feel like I'd just like to find out what this guy's up to. So according to this official wiretap report, there are, you know, roughly 2,000 intercept orders approved by judges every year. In 87, it was more like 750. It's gone up. Year 2000, it was about 1,250. And it kind of peaked in 2007 at about 2,200. Gone down a little bit since then. Total intercepts authorized. So you might say, if you looked at that report produced every year, presented to Congress and the public, that, you know, that's good. That seems about right. That seems about right. It's a little different when it comes to watching your cell phone. It's a little different if a law enforcement official wants to know where you were at a certain time, or what phone numbers you call, or what text messages, emails, and instant messages you send from your mobile phone. Turns out that a lot of information can be obtained from your phone company, your cell phone company, without a warrant. Intercept orders, wiretap orders, are required to, you have to get court permission to monitor the contents of real-time communication. But if it's so-called non-content information, things like the to, from, and subject lines of email messages, the URLs of pages you view, including your searches, because, you know, every time you do a search, the URL is visible, the telephone numbers you dial, all of those can be obtained not with a warrant, not with a wiretap, but with something called a pen register trap and trace order. Pen register is a lot easier to get. And they're also not included in this wiretap report. So we don't know exactly. Well, we should know because the law in 1999, a law was passed that said the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General, had to compile annual statistics on the use of pen register orders by the Department of Justice and submit it to Congress. The last time they did that was 2004, when 5 years of reports were provided in a big document dump, and that nothing's done since. Congress and the public have not seen that information since. Well, this fella, Christopher Segoyan, has done a little digging, a little research into public records, and has found some pretty shocking information. There are a lot of pen register in requests. A lot of these requests asking for numbers that people called or GPS coordinates or... Now they go to not just your wireless carrier, but your internet service provider and even social networks. Facebook and AOL have disclosed, and this was a couple of years ago, so it could be a lot more, that they get each about 1,000 requests a month. A month. Remember, we only saw 2,000 wiretaps in 2007. Cox Communications actually has a surveillance price list, a pen register price list, because they say, well, it costs us money to give you this information. So for the first 60 days of a pen register trap and trace, we'll charge you $2,500. It's $2,000 for each additional 60 days and $3,500 for the first 30 days of a wiretap, followed by $2,500 for each additional 30 days. And you don't need a warrant. You don't need a court order. Companies, it turns out all the companies, charge law enforcement for this. It's a profit center for them, so they don't really want anybody to know. And there are many, many, many requests. Verizon, for instance, says they get tens of thousands of requests, tens of thousands of requests for customer records each year. Tens of thousands for Verizon alone. Yahoo, when asked to reveal this information, wrote back and said, it's reasonable to assume from these comments that the pricing information, if disclosed, would be used to shame the pricing information for these pen intercepts, how much they would charge, would be used to shame Yahoo and other companies and to shock their customers. Therefore, release of Yahoo's information is reasonably likely to lead to impairment of its reputation for protection of user privacy. So they petitioned the court not to to let them not reveal this information. Federal officials routinely ask courts to order cell phone companies to furnish real-time tracking data. Law enforcement routinely requests carriers to continuously ping wireless devices of suspects to locate them, even when a call's not being made. These pen register and stored communication requests are getting more and more common. In fact, Christopher Segoyan, after putting it all together, he went to some conferences. He says he found a research paper. He went to an event called the ISS World, which is the Intelligence Support Systems for Lawful Interception, Criminal Investigations, and Intelligence Gathering. It's basically a gathering of spooks in Washington, D.C., where they talk about techniques for surveilling people. He went to a panel meeting in which he learned that one wireless company had 8 million law enforcement requests for customer GPS information in 1 year. 8 million. Now remember back at the beginning I said the 2,000 lawful wiretaps a year? 8 million GPS requests a year from one carrier alone. This is Sprint Nextel. That's Paul Taylor, who's the electronics surveillance manager at Sprint Nextel. He says, my group at Sprint Nextel, I have 3 supervisors, 30 techs, 15 contractors. And on the subpoena compliance side, which is anything historical, 35 employees. This is big business for these companies. Millions of requests. Did you have any idea that law enforcement, in fact, Sprint created a website, a web portal, so people could go, the law enforcement officials could go to this web portal, pay a couple of bucks and find out where you are. And the attorney general has been, I can understand why now, has been unlawfully not reporting this information for the last 6 years. Wow. I thought this was stunning. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's paranoia.dubfire.net. 8 million requests for real surveillance. It's a fascinating piece, well-researched. I've seen nothing from anybody, no denials to make me think it's not true. I just thought, you know, this is something we ought to know. Law enforcement is routinely and all the time asking for and getting information about where you are from your cell phone. I might be using a landline. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's use the landline. Go take some calls right after this. The Tech Guy, and we are on the phones answering your calls for help. I used to do a show called Call for Help. Vaughn, is it Vaughn in Edmonton, Alberta, has a call for help. Hey, Vaughn.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Keeping warm.
Hey, good. What's up?
A couple things. I'm redoing my website. My website's old and drabby. And I'm a photographer, and I've looked at various different sites, including Squarespace's Livebooks and Blue Domain, in terms of using their templates. Some of them are mainly Flash-based websites. But
Stay away, because you want people with iPads and iPhones to visit.
Correct. Yeah, actually, Livebooks does also give you iPad, iPhone capability.
Oh, that's nice.
In there, they can look at your site that way.
That's good.
However, everybody, like I've been listening to you for a long, long time, and everybody is touting search engine optimization.
Yes, aren't they?
And I wanted to kind of get your take on it, and I know you are a big fan of being careful, and there's a lot of
stuff
out there being touted, and I even had, like, this year my Yellow Pages ad, you know, I didn't renew it because I didn't get any business from it, but they were really pushing search engine optimization. You know,
of course they are. They're trying to sell you something.
Yeah.
If you were in the Yellow Pages business these days, wouldn't you be looking for a new line of work?
Right. Yeah, they are. They're by their different practices.
I really wouldn't want to be selling the Yellow Pages right now.
Yeah, me neither.
So, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of people who claim to be SEOs are exactly that, former Yellow Pages salesman.
Could be.
But there is a legitimate it's a legitimate idea. The idea being, you want your page to show up well when people search for keywords that are related to what you're up to.
Right.
So what kind of photography do you do?
Mainly wedding and lifestyle.
Okay. So you'd love it if somebody searches for wedding photographer Edmonton, that your site shows up.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. And I've registered on Google Analytics, and I'm also looking at the Webmaster tool, so I've registered there as well. I haven't finished doing the new site yet, and but you know, I just want to just make sure I'm doing it right.
Yeah, I mean, you probably intuitively know most of what you need to do. Google also will give you, if you go to their webmaster tools, will give you some good insight. One of the things they say, make sure you have a sitemap. Any good tool like Squarespace will do that automatically. WordPress will do it automatically. It's probably important that you include in the text on your site. I know you're a photographer, so you're going to have a lot of pictures, but do include some text that has keywords like wedding, Edmonton, things like that. So, I mean, that's what Google sees. It doesn't see the pictures.
Correct.
And so, you know, nobody can search for a wedding photo if your pictures don't have the text wedding photo somewhere on that page.
Correct.
It is also said, and there's some debate over the merit of this, that it's important that the page title itself contain the kinds of keywords you're looking for. It certainly wouldn't be a bad thing for your title for your webpage to say, you know, your name and wedding photographer or wedding and travel, whatever it is that you want to have it say. All of those things will help you get ranked well in Google. The thing that gets you best ranked in Google is having other people link to your site. Google's PageRank algorithm, which is how they do their job, really is it depends on one thing. It comes from the notion that if a lot of good sites link to a site, then that site must be good too. And so the more sites, the more highly ranked sites that link to your site, the higher rank you'll be.
Okay.
That's kind of mainly how Google works.
Of course, yeah. And what kind of things should I be careful of not to get bounced?
Well, and then and this is the risk of aggressive SEO can get you in trouble with Google. And of course, if Google doesn't like you, if they think you're spamming Google, they will punish you by removing you from their index, which effectively, as far as I'm concerned, means you don't exist.
Yeah.
If you can't be Googled, it's pretty hard for people to figure out that you are there. So, but you have to be pretty nasty to do that. You have to do things that are very spammy. For instance, I said you should have other people link to you. That's a good idea. But if you were to go out and create 20 sites, false sites that linked to you, that's a bad idea. Because Google is going to say, wait a minute, are these real sites linking, or are these? Is this guy creating his own sites? And that's what sometimes SEOs will do.
True.
They will create what we call link farms, which are pages that contain no content on their own. They just link back to the clients. Now, Google's not stupid. And if they catch you doing this kind of thing, they could very well punish you. They could sandbox you or otherwise slow down your search results. So you've got to be careful so that you don't do stuff like that. You're not going to do stuff like that. What you should do is go to other, you know, would be great ideas. I don't know if there are photography directories. I imagine there are. I would go and make sure, yeah, make sure you're listed in those. Make sure other photographers link to you, probably non-competitive photographers. If, you know, if there is a wedding photographer in Vancouver that doesn't compete with you, say, hey, I'll link to you if you'll link to me.
Lots of friends in the U.S. as well. You know,
perfect. Perfect.
And then how long does it usually take? Like, you know, Yellow Pages guys, when I met with those guys, they say, oh, yeah, within like, you know, within 3 to 6 months, we can get you a top ranking for Edmonton wedding photographers. But really, that's not, that doesn't sound.
No. I mean, if they say that, then what they're saying is we get a lot of Google juice on our site. In other words, we have a lot. We are a highly ranked site for Google. And so when we link to you, that will help you. And there is some merit to that. But really, anytime somebody makes a promise like that, that is immediately, for me, a red flag. It's very hard to promise what Google's going to do.
Correct.
So you were right to say, wait a minute.
Yeah, I didn't.
I mean, there is some merit. There's some value. Just as there's value in getting listed in photography directories, there's some value to getting listed in the Yellow Pages directory. Google.
To be honest with you, Leo, the amount that they were charging, I'd be better off just to go to.
I agree.
On Google.
I agree. And really, you know, I've actually counseled some friends who get the same hard sell from the Yellow Pages folks here in the States. That's probably, look it, you know, you can answer this question yourself. If you were looking for a wedding photographer in Edmonton, where would you go? Google or Yellow Pages?
Yeah, I'd go to Google.
You'd go to Google. Of course you would. Why do you think the Yellow Pages people are saying we can help you with Google? That just tells you they're not really selling a product you need. Being in their directory isn't that good because people, frankly, that's old behavior. People don't go to the Yellow Pages site to find stuff. They Google it.
That's right.
Yep. Nobody. That's why the Yellow Pages are in trouble, because we don't need them anymore. You can take your book and keep it. Save a tree. I don't need it because I have Google. So the job of anybody who creates a site is to Google says this themselves. Create a great site with great content. People visit and link to and talk about. Do your best to get people talking about it by going to photography forums. You know, it's probably a good idea to go do the things you already do to market yourself. Go to those wedding shows and things like that. You know, get people to talk about you and link to you. And if you've got a bride who has pictures that she's really happy with, say, hey, don't forget when you put your pictures on your site for grandma and grandpa to put a link to my site right next to it. That'll help.
Yep. Okay.
What's your site?
Well, my old one, I don't know if I want to give it to you, but I'll give it to you anyway.
Okay. Give me the one you're proud of. You don't have one yet then.
I have one, but I don't want to give it to you. I can phone you back and then
call me back in a month when you've done this great new site, Vaughn, and we'll plug it to the world.
Okay. That'd be great.
Meanwhile, search for Vaughn Wedding Photography Edmonton. I bet you show up.
Got it.
Thanks, Vaughn.
Okay. Thanks.
take care. Yeah. There's a lot of snake oil in all this, and it's really pretty simple. I have in the past sent people to a site called Buzzle, BUZZLE.com, where they talk about the Google PageRank technology. If you Google PageRank and Buzzle, you'll find a good article there. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Tech Guy Show, brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme, for high-speed internet at an amazingly low price. Call 866, the number 2, get net, to get DSL Extreme. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888, Ask Leo. Dave was asking, he has a new Evo, And he was saying, well, I'd like to, when I show up at a place, have the Wi-Fi recognized and have it start using Wi-Fi automatically. And of course, your phone will do that. That's, you can set it to do that. I was talking to Kyle, who's in here in a Droid. What is that, an Incredible? What is it? The HTC Desire HD he's using. And so I use Android too. And iPhone, it's the same story. You can say, you know, if you see an open access spot, let me know. And you can even have it join. I think you can have it join automatically. If not, there are programs like Locale, which is a great Android program, and Tasker, right? Which will notice and have you join automatically. In fact, Locale's cool because Locale turns things on and off more than just the Wi-Fi, depending on where you are. And you configure it. So you say, well, if I'm here, do this. If I'm there, do that. Only do this when I'm on this access spot, that kind of thing. And that's pretty cool. All of these things will use battery life. Even using the feature that when you see Wi-Fi join, open Wi-Fi join it automatically, which the Evo will do, even that is using battery because periodically it has to go out and say, do I see Wi-Fi? Is there any Wi-Fi here? Anytime. And in order to do that, what does it do? It turns on the Wi-Fi, turns on the antenna, looks around. All of that's going to use some juice. If, as in Dave's case, he's so happy because the pre was worse. If you're happy with the Evo, then I think turn those things on. Maybe take a look at Tasker or Locale. Locale's a very cool program. For example, whenever I am in the car, my phone's plugged in. Whenever I'm at my desk in my office, my phone's plugged in. So, you know, I'm always charging my phone back up. I only really notice the lack of battery life when I'm out in the field and I just can't plug in anywhere. Traveling, things like that. And for cases like that, maybe get an extra battery. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's get back to the phones. Frank in Fresno. You've been hanging on for a while, Frank. Thanks for your patience. What can I do for you?
Hey, morning, Leo. Hey, thank you for taking my call. Hopefully it's not too foggy up there compared to here in this area.
Are you kidding? I'm up in Northern California. It's a beautiful, it's like 65 degrees. The sun. I don't want to say that because a blizzard's hitting our friends on the East Coast right now.
Hey, two quick questions, Leo. The first one has to do with my speed on my computer. The second would be my printer, Epson. Anyway, the first question, how do I improve my speed? Because I finished building my computer back in, I think, September or August last time I talked to you. It has 12 gigs of RAM. It's running on Intel 7, Windows 7 as well.
Boy, that's fast. Everything's fast.
Yeah. But
you're saying it should be faster.
Right. Now, is it for some reason, is it hugging the RAM somewhere
I would guess you've got a very fast processor. You've got more RAM than you need. You got plenty of RAM, and you don't have too much RAM. You added it. I noticed in triplets, which is in some situations that's what you want to do. 12 is a good number. Sometimes you know it's 3, 6, 9. Sometimes it's 2, 4, 6, 8. You add your RAM. Depends on the processor. But you can't go wrong with 12. It's both odd and even, you know, it's divisible by 3 and 2. So I think you're all right with the amount of RAM. I would guess it's IO.
IO.
Input. Yeah. Input, output. A lot of stuff on your computer is what there. When you look at a task that a computer is doing, you can most commonly divide it between tasks that are CPU bound, that are dependent on how fast the CPU is, GPU bound, how fast the graphics card is, or IO bound, how fast disk access is. And for a fast computer, you need to have the appropriate speed where you need it. You've got plenty of CPU. You're definitely not CPU bound. For things that run out of memory, you've got plenty. So things like Photoshop, where you have lots of data in memory, 12 is great. I would bet you got a very fast graphics card to go with that i7. If you didn't, you should have. So I doubt your GPU bound. And that only, by the way, comes up when you're playing video games, frankly. 3D rendering in real time. So I'm going to guess that you got everything else settled. It's the I.O. that's slow. It's one of the reasons that, for instance, we were talking about the MacBook Air. Now, that's a slow processor. And they start with 2 gigs of RAM. And yet people say, this is a fast computer. Why is it so fast with a 1.6 gigahertz Core 2 processor? And that's a slow processor. Well, because it's got an SSD, a solid state drive that's really fast. And it turns out a fast hard drive can make the whole computer seem faster. So my guess, Frank, is that you didn't get fast enough hard drives. You spent a lot of money, so maybe the thing to do if you want to spend a little bit more is get a small solid-state hard drive for your boot disk. 64 gigs would be plenty. Put Windows and your apps on there. Now, it's too small to put a lot of data on, and I bet you have a lot of data, video, movies, pictures, that kind of thing. So put the data on a regular spinning drive, even the one you've got probably, is fine. By booting from and running your stuff off a solid-state drive, things will speed up incredibly. Get a good solid-state drive. I'll tell you what. Go to PCPer.com and look at their solid-state drive recommendations. PC Perspective. My friend Alan Malventano is a solid-state drive nutball. He's just a guru of solid-state drives, knows everything there is to know about it, and he's reviewed them all, and those reviews change a lot. Generally speaking, look for one with a SandForce controller. He'll tell you which makes use those controllers. Corsair's very good. That's what I use. That can make a huge difference. Another thing to do is perhaps if the computer, if you've been using it for a while, it's not that it gets fragmented, but it's that bad sectors on a drive can really slow you down. So a program like SpinRite, which is a $90 program, don't run it on the solid state drive, but run it on the spinning drive, the standard drive. If a sector is marginal, cannot be read readily by the computer, but you need that data, maybe a bit of Windows is sitting on that, the computer will slow down as it tries to read it. And if there's a bunch of marginal disks, sectors, that can actually slow everything down. So I'm saying look at the disk, get a faster drive, the solid state drive, and if you've got a spinning disk, scan that and make sure you don't have bad or marginal sectors. SpinRite is a good program for that. You run it on that disk. It'll say, if I can't read this right away, I'm going to move data off of it and mark it unusable. That can make a big difference. It's I.O. that really, if you've got everything else and you do, I.O. that really can make a big difference there. We often ignore the speed of the disk. May I make one more recommendation? Make sure you have a good backup strategy. You've got a lot of data. You got to back it up. And if you're going to back it up, do it right, Pilgrim. Do it right, Pilgrim, with Carbonite. I'm sorry. That's a bad impression. Today could be the day one of those three things happen to your computers. It crashes, or you get a virus worming its way into your hard drive, or maybe you just, drop your laptop or lose it. You know, thousands of laptops are lost every single day at airports. In an instant, all your pictures, all your priceless files, your data lost forever. How would you feel? If you got Carbonite Online Backup, that takes the sting out of it because your data's safe. Carbonite's easy. It's automatic. Anybody can start right now for free at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Leo. And this is something I really want to remind people about. It's in a way, it's a great solution because it gives you access to your data no matter where you are. If you log on to your Carbonite account, you can get your data on an iPhone, on a BlackBerry, on any computer, anytime, anywhere. Try it free. It's $55 a year for PC or Mac at Carbonite.com. But you've got a free 15-day trial there if you use my name, Leo. When you check out, when you decide to buy, and I know you will, use my name, Leo, for an additional 2 free months. Carbonite.com. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right at Carbonite. Ben in Minneapolis coming up at 47 after the hour. He wants to know, what kind of memory to put in his Windows phone? Bad news. You can't. Details to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. That's the number. Karen called from Huntington Beach, California. Hi, Karen. Leo Laporte here.
Hi there. I'm so glad to talk with you. I'm one of the non-techie people that loves your show anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, we need to get everybody to listen. I can't just stick with the techies. So thank you.
Well,
what can I do to help you?
I'm calling about a very non-technical question, and that is I do a lot of reports for my work, and primarily I use the computer for those, and I use QuickBooks, and then I save all my travel pictures. And it's time for me to get a new desktop computer, and I'm real interested in what you'd recommend.
Unfortunately, QuickBooks, and I mean this, requires Internet Explorer, which means, you know, you have to use Windows. You have QuickBooks Online, or use QuickBooks on Windows. I should say only QuickBooks Online requires IE. Oh, okay, so you could use. Okay, so that's the software version, but you do still need Windows. The only pretty much, you know, PCs are PCs. To be honest with you, I'm a Dell fan, but Dell has as many problems as anybody else. HP tends to load their machines up with junk, which I'm not fond of, but you can get rid of it. Are you going to get a laptop or a desktop? Do you know?
I've got a laptop, but I'm going to get a desktop this time.
Okay. I think Dell has some very good-looking all-in-one desktops that are not too expensive. I caution anybody about, sometimes you look at these prices and you see the loss leaders, you know, the $400 or $500 computers, and I caution you a little bit about being too cheap.
Uh-huh.
Mostly because they cut corners to get that price down. And sometimes they have a Windows Starter Edition instead of the Full Edition. Sometimes they don't have much memory in them, or the drives are small, or more likely they'll use slower chips. And they're just slower. They're just not, you know, and they're not as well made. So consider, you know, it used to be we said the computer you want is always $2,500. That's a lot less now. It's about $1,000.
Okay.
I would say you're going to spend $1,000 though. Don't get a $400 computer. That would be my biggest advice.
Alrighty. And it's,
yeah.
As though you were thinking Mac.
Well, I'd like to point people towards Macs if possible for several reasons. One, most importantly, they're less of a security risk. They're not nearly the number. In fact, really, there aren't any attacks against Macs unless they're specifically against individuals. There's no widespread attacks against Macs. I think in many cases, Macs are better built. They are more expensive, and that's one of the reasons they're more expensive. But you can't run QuickBooks on one. You can't. You know, it's funny. Walt Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal said, the best Windows machine is a Mac. And it's true that you can run Windows on Macintoshes, but you have to buy Windows, which is a cost.
Yeah.
So I would say it's fine to get it. You've been using Windows. It sounds like you kind of want to get more do more stuff than you used to do. You want to kind of get into computers a little bit.
No, not particularly. it's just that I want to get a good computer for my money, and I need it to last.
Right. I'll tell you, I put my money where my mouth is when I equip my office. And, of course, in the office, they're using QuickBooks. They need Windows. I buy Dells.
Okay.
And I think Dells are very robust, very reliable. The desktops, they make very affordable desktops. Here's a couple of things I'd say. Get 4 gigs of RAM.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they sell 2. 4 is really what you want. You don't need more, but 4 is good. I would say get the biggest screen you can afford.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much productivity the screen can really enhance your productivity, a big screen.
Yes.
I would say hard drive size for you is, you know, if you're just putting pictures on it, is probably not going to be an issue. You're going to get almost certainly at least 500 gigs, which is a lot.
Okay.
And then I would say probably the processor you're looking at is an Intel i5.
Okay.
If you really want to save money, you could get an i3 or a Core 2. They're still selling those, but I'm going to future-proof you a little bit and say get an i5.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about a Mac, and I really like the little ones where you don't have as much machine.
They're beautiful. The MacBook Airs are gorgeous.
They're really beautiful, but I realize it would be more difficult to transfer all my information.
You know, there is QuickBooks for Mac. It's just a different license, and it's not in the same category as QuickBooks for Windows.
Okay.
So if you really, I mean, it sounds like QuickBooks is your primary thing.
Well, QuickBooks and Word.
Word's available on the Mac, and it's identical. It was pretty much identical.
When on the Mac would you recommend
If you like the, you know, I mean, look, the MacBook Air is the best computer of the year, in my opinion. It's called the Air. That's the little thin one. It's a laptop. It's not a desktop.
Okay.
But it's tiny. But I mean, it's so light. It's what I carry with me everywhere. It's replaced all my other computers. It only has 64 gigs of disk space. So you have to keep stuff in the cloud. You know, that'd be, you know, and running Windows on it, you can, by the way, and it runs Windows beautifully. But you don't have so much storage. So it's like having Windows is going to take up even a bigger chunk of what is already limited. I think, you know, it's very prosaic. It's very beige box. But just get a Dell, you know?
All right.
And if you want sexy, put aside $1,000 and get a MacBook Air. Most people don't. You're not the, you know, there's, I think there's two kinds of users. There's the users of computers who think of them as a tool. And there's the users who are enthusiasts who think of them as a toy. You're clearly a tool user. This is a productivity tool for you.
Oh, and it's a wonderful tool for me, because I remember the days when I was doing clerical work and had to use the carbon paper.
Oh, yeah. This is a huge improvement.
And I did my master's thesis on a typewriter.
Right. No, I agree. This is, and I'm the same vintage as you, and this is a huge step forward. And that's why when I look at the Air, I go, wow,
yeah.
It's a supercomputer that weighs 2 pounds.
And that is a desktop, you said? I mean,
no, that's a laptop. Yeah. So, and Mac, Apple sells these, iMacs, which are very, I think, very nice desktops. That's my preferred desktop, but they're pricey compared to a PC.
Yeah.
You're paying, I would say in general, you pay about 50% more for a Macintosh than you do for a PC.
Okay. Thank you, Leo.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Welcome. Bye.
And have fun. And if you have problems, you know where to go. 8888 Ask Leo. The Air is for the toy people, the enthusiast side, not the tool people. I mean, it's a great tool. I shouldn't say that. It's a great tool. But it's just, it's for people who look at computers and go, ooh. If you look at a computer and say that's replacing carbon paper spreadsheets and a typewriter, you're using it as a tool, then it doesn't, you know, the ooh ah, it's going to only last a few weeks, and then you're going to say, well, how is it working as a tool for me? Same thing with the iPad. You know, iPad has a lot of appeal. I'm not going to call it sex appeal, because that's a terrible word to use for computer hardware, but it has appeal. But it is not, it is more for consuming content than for creating content. And I would hate to try to do my books on an iPad. That'd be the last thing I'd recommend. Let's go to Lake Superior, Wisconsin. I'm sorry, Michigan, and Ted. Hey, Ted.
Hey, how you doing, Leo? Listened to a lot of your CES coverage and watched some of it, and it was very good.
Thank you. We had a blast there.
Yeah, it sounded like it. Hey, Leo, I have a question about Slingbox and one about what the newest Verizon hardware would be to get now with a better camera. I have a Droid X right now, but I have one of my other phones are up, and I was wondering, other than the iPhone, I want to wait for the 5. I have a lot of phones, and I'll be replacing most of them in the next 6-8 months. But
Ted, you're a man after my own heart, a cell phone fanatic.
Exactly. Well, you know what? You remember the old Red Fox show there, the Junkyard Show?
Yeah.
I'm coming, Wheezy!
In the cabinet looking for glasses all the time?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I am with cell phones.
You never, that's one way not to lose a phone is to have 12 of them. So, yeah, I think you're right. The iPhone 5 will come out in June. The iPhone 4 has the best camera on any cell phone. I think that the Samsung Galaxy Series 5 megapixels are very good as well. The Droid X, you know, a lot of this is the software and the lens. The Droid X is 8 megapixels, but you probably notice there's a lot of flaring in the pictures I've found. They're not as crisp. They're not as high def as the 5 megapixel pictures coming out of the iPhone 4. A great way to do this, by the way, is to go to Flickr and search for the phone model you're interested in. Lots of people posting their camera phone pictures on Flickr, and you can see a whole bunch of pictures taken with any given camera phone. And that's a really great way to judge them. I think the Galaxy is very close to the iPhone 4. I'll be very curious to see what Apple does with the iPhone 5. Thanks for the call. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you? Leo Laborde here, the tech guy, and it's time to talk about all those cool techie things that are invading our lives. Computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, 8888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number, 888-827-5536. If you'd like to join us anywhere in the U.S., that's toll-free. Outside the U.S., Skype in. Won't cost you a penny. 888-827-5536. So, Eric, this was a shock. On Thursday, I was wrapping up one of my podcasts, Windows Weekly, and somebody in the chat room, this is one of the things I love about the chat room. They are like Twitter, Twitter's probably the next analogy. They're the early warning system. They're the news of the internet. You know, if you keep Twitter, you know, running in the background as I do, anything important happens, you're going to see it. And our chat room is like that. And probably what happened was it came first through the Twitter feed. The chat room saw it and picked it up and told me. But what a shocker. Google's earning call for their fourth quarter. And they announce, besides great earnings, that their CEO is stepping down. Google's boss is stepping down. And even a bigger surprise, one of the founders of Google, Larry Page, the man Google's PageRank is named after, the guy who figured out the whole thing back as a graduate student at Stanford, is taking over. That's kind of the reverse life cycle for most tech startups. Usually, the founders run it for a while and then realize they need some adult supervision. And they bring in a professional manager, somebody with lots of experience, like, let's say, Eric Schmidt, who ran Novell for many years, has lots of experience as a CEO. They bring him in, and he runs the place, and that's it for the founders. They slowly fade away, you know, buy yachts, which they're doing. Larry's buying a 45-foot yacht. Buy Gulfstream private jets. They have several. Become playboys, you know, enjoy life. They're rich. They're rich. They don't need to run a company. And the founders fade off. This company goes public, makes everybody a lot of money, and then becomes just another company. Google's never been just another company, have they? They've always had a different kind of vision. In fact, Eric Schmidt tweeted about this, and he said, no adult supervision no longer needed. He says that they'd been talking about this since Christmas. I think Google has a tradition basically it was the three of them. Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who founded Google, and who in the early days of Google were very accessible. You could talk to them. They were great guys, very interesting, very smart. And then the adult supervision, Eric Schmidt, the CEO. Eric, in the last year, though, has kind of maybe been not a huge asset. I don't know. I can't speak for in how they feel internally. But I have to say, from the point of view of an outsider, a journalist covering Google, has not been a huge asset. He said things that just make people feel a little creepy about Google. He was the subject of that very creepy video. Remember, I don't know if I talked about this on the show, they showed it in Times Square. A public interest group made a video of Eric Schmidt as an ice cream man going around collecting information. It was a creepy ice cream man about the kids. It's really creepy. He'd really become the focus of people's nervousness about Google and Google's intentions. And, you know, he kind of looked the part. He wasn't the young, hip entrepreneur. He was the suit. And he said things that were a little odd. So I have to wonder if some of this is the founder saying, yeah, well, thank you. You're running the company well, but we don't think you represent the company that well. He's going to be moved upstairs, basically up and out is what they call it. Larry Page will run the company. He'll be the CEO starting in April 4th. And Sergey Brin, the other founder, is going to be the product guy. This is kind of how a traditional startup works. It may be part of it is that Google wants to be more like a startup and less like a mainline big company. They've always kind of thought that would be the best way to be. In fact, it's one of the things that kind of hurt Microsoft is that loss of the entrepreneurial spirit, of the nimbleness, of the aggressiveness of a startup. And once you become a company like IBM, you're just coasting. And I think Google doesn't want that to happen to them. So quite a shock. And, you know, one of the questions a lot of people say is, well, was he fired? Well, I don't think he stepped down voluntarily. There was no talk about this. It just happened quite suddenly. I think it's in all likelihood he's going willingly. They gave him a $100 million bonus. He is a multi-billionaire, thanks to Google. Doesn't need the money. There's probably a lot of other things he can do. It's not a question of that. Some pride, I'm sure, involved, and he was very gracious in his post. He blogged about it, but the tweet is a little shows some sting, doesn't it? No more adult supervision needed. The kids are taking over. There's a little sting. I sense a little hurt. Here's some of the Gizmodo. Thanks to the chat room for posting this link. Gizmodo had a post: 10 things we can't believe Eric Schmidt ever said. One of the things that Larry and Sergey said is our motto is don't be evil. We don't want to be evil. We want to be a successful company without doing evil. Eric said once, one person's definition of evil is another person's different definition. Huh? Here's another one. One day we had a conversation where we figured we could just try and predict the stock market, and then we decided it was illegal, so we stopped doing that. Eric's the guy who said, we want Google to tell you what you should be doing next. You know, I understand what Eric's saying, and I don't, it doesn't scare me, but it doesn't come off well when he says more and more searches are done on your behalf without your needing to type. I actually think most people don't want Google to answer their questions. They want Google to tell them what they should be doing next. Now, I understand what he means when he says that, but boy, that scares normal people like crazy. To me, that's what we want. We want the computer to be smart enough to kind of know what we want so we don't have to ask it. We just, you know, it just says, oh, I know where you are. You're probably looking for this. Let me give you that information. That doesn't bother me as a technologist, but I bet it bothers a lot of other people, and it's probably not the right thing for your CEO to be saying in public. Here's one of his most famous ones. Google's policy is to get right up to the creepy line and not cross it. I don't think people hear that and not cross it. They just hear Google's policy is to get right up to the creepy line. Eric, I can just imagine. One of the reasons we like Google is they're not quite so polished. I'd be a lot more scared of Google if they were really polished and effective and had a great, you know, PR front. And in a way, it's kind of interesting to hear the CEO say what he really thinks. However, I have to think that it hurt him a little bit. Those were all this year. Or 2010, I should say. And so I think that it's telling that Eric is moving down, that Larry Page, the founder, is moving in. And I think the goal is to make Google back, turn Google back into an entrepreneurial startup where they began. Can they do it? Be interesting to watch. We don't know if Keith Olbermann or Eric Schmidt were fired, but boy, it sure looks like they both were, doesn't it? 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk about your tech, because I know people like gossiping about this kind of thing, but really, this show is about helping you use computers and getting the most out of them. 8888 Ask Leo. 888-275-5536. And More of your calls coming up in just a little bit. The website is techguylabs.com. And if you want to join us in the chat room, that's really a fun place to be. That's where the side conversations go on. That's irc.twit.tv. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go, and I think Jim's been hanging on the longest. He's in New Jersey. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, Leo. I'd like to thank you. This is the second time I've called you. This time I have a Windows Mobile problem.
Okay.
I basically run Macs. I have a PC on the one Mac, and I'm looking for a desktop that I can run on the Mac side, which I probably downloaded a good one. I haven't put it on yet from Apple, but I'm looking mainly for the one on the PC side that I can use as a desktop for it, because I have programs that use both that I want to put on the Windows Mobile phone.
Confused. So, so
well, I'm a little more nervous than the first time I called.
Let me see if I can understand this. You got a Mac.
Yeah, and you know,
you got a Windows phone, and what you want to do is have some software on your Mac that can talk to the Windows phone. Is that it?
Well, yes, but I also have programs that I want to use on the PC side, so I need something like a top.
I get what you're saying. You need what's called virtualization, the ability to run one operating system under another.
Right.
In this case, you want to run Windows. In fact, this is the best way to talk to your Windows phone, because frankly, there's not really any good way to talk to a Windows phone from a Mac. You want a way to run Windows on your Mac. And Apple offers a way to do this called Boot Camp, which it requires taking over the Mac, you know, splitting the Mac hard drive into two, and sometimes you're running Windows, sometimes Mac. There's a better way. And it's free. It's called VirtualBox. It's at virtualbox.org. It comes from Sun. Sun designed it. And the idea is you run VirtualBox, and then it'll say, okay, great. Give me a disk. I want to install the operating system. And you give it an XP disk or whatever version of Windows you happen to have lying around. You'll install it. And now here's the beauty part. You're running Macintosh. You're running along, and you want to run your Windows phone software. You just open up the VirtualBox, boot Windows. Windows is running in a window on the Mac desktop. It's still there. And you run the software and you tell the USB port, hey, that port, that goes to the VirtualBox, not to the Mac. The VirtualBox Windows version will see the phone, will launch the phone software and everything. You'll be just like you're using Windows on that Macintosh.
Leo, I'm running Parallels right now.
Parallels is a good choice, too. It's a commercial program. VMware Fusion is another one, also commercial. Only reason I recommend VirtualBox is because it's free, but it's not quite as good as Parallels, so I think you're actually better off.
Now, what I'm looking for is like the Palm desktop, but only for Windows Mobile.
Yeah, there isn't like Windows Mobile doesn't work that way. There, unlike the Palm desktop. So you're looking for Windows software that will have a calendar, address book, and notes and all of that stuff for your Windows phone, but it doesn't really work that way. The way Windows phones are designed is to use the Windows programs like Outlook or Outlook Express I don't know what they use for the calendar. Probably the Windows calendar. No, I guess Outlook. I mean, Outlook basically is it. What version of Windows, Jim, are you using? Are you using XP or something? Yeah. I think ActiveSync and Outlook is what you want to do. Do you have Outlook?
I guess so. I don't play that much on the PC side. Just the programs I had that only work on PC I use.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because Palm and BlackBerry both give you software. But Windows, Microsoft doesn't do that with their Windows phones. Their Windows phones are designed to work with Windows and the Windows software.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I thank you for the information.
You're welcome,
and
Jim.
And I'd like to thank you one more time. Last time I was on, I mentioned my wife's website, numberpower.org, and I'd like to thank all the people that went on the site and found all the mistakes she made.
Yeah, you got to be careful. I have a great audience, but they have sharp eyes. And thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. If you haven't yet done virtualization on the Mac, I think it's pretty cool what Sun has done. I'm sorry, Oracle bought Sun, so it's really an Oracle product now. Sun has done with VirtualBox. They just released version 4 of it. It's open source. It runs on Windows, Linux, Mac, and OpenSolaris. And you can run a variety of other operating systems. They call them guest operating systems on these. So most commonly, it's used to run something like Windows on a Macintosh. And yes, Parallels and VMware Fusion have additional features. They might be a little better for 3D graphics and so forth. But this is free. This is free. There's a lot to be said for free, especially if you're casually using Windows. You're not trying to play games or do anything really hardcore or high end. Arthur in Rochester, Minnesota. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Arthur.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you for calling. What can I do for you?
Well, at my work computer, I've installed VLC, and when I'm using that, I can stream a radio station from online. I'd like to do the same thing with my home computer, and I've installed the VLC here, but whenever I try to start streaming, iTunes pops up and tries to take it.
Yeah, because iTunes says, no, that's my job.
Right.
So you must be double-clicking a file.
How do you launch that?
Do you launch it in a browser?
Yes, from the radio.
Okay. Oh, from the radio station. Yeah, so, it's just like a file extension. You're getting a playlist file from the radio station, and that file, you're actually downloading and running a file, believe it or not, and that file is attached to iTunes. So what you need to do is tell your Mac, no, when you get an M3 MU or whatever it is you're getting, you need to play that through VLC.
Okay, this is a Windows PC Vista, not a Mac.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was a Mac. Same thing, though. So when you said iTunes, I foolishly assumed Macintosh. Okay. My mistake. Same idea as file association. Okay. So what you're going to do is instead of clicking that radio station link, what you want to do is get the file that's attached to it. See if you can right-click it and save target as, that kind of thing, or save file as. If you can save it, you can then change the file association. You'll see what it is. It's probably... It depends on the station, but it's probably a playlist file. It's a short, small file that says, here's where the radio station is.
Yep.
You need to tell Windows, when you see a file with this extension, I want you to open VLC.
Okay. So it's sort of like the old file association.
It's exactly what it is. It is a file association because when you click that link at the radio station, what you're really doing is downloading a small file. It's either a PLS, an M3U, an ASX. It's a playlist file. Now, you could, since you know you want everything to play in VLC, what you could do is go to the default programs program. Are you Windows 7?
Vista.
Vista. Yeah, they have that default programs. They added that to Vista.
Okay.
And go in there and say, hey, if you see a PLS M3U or ASX file.
Associated.
Open.
Or protocol.
Yeah. Yeah. Associated. Open that with VLC. Associate that to VLC.
Okay. And it's loading. Okay, I didn't even know where to go if this was a...
I know, because you don't even see a file. You're just clicking a link.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Now I see a bunch of things pop up. I think I can take it from here then.
I think you get the idea, exactly. It's a file. Yeah, that's it. That's the ticket. File association. Now I understand it. Oh, I only have 30 seconds left. I think we're out of time, I'm sorry to say, but we'll get some more calls in just a little bit. Don't forget the website, techguylabs.com, because we've got to take a break right now. Techguylabs.com. We've got all the notes there. Links to our chat room, our video, and a whole lot more. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. Jerry's been very patient. Jerry, thank you for hanging on from Running Springs, California. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Fantastic. Welcome to the show.
Nothing better than sitting looking at it snowing outside and listening to you on the radio and watching.
Wow. You must be in the mountains.
I am. Running Springs, Lake Arrowhead area.
Oh, it's gorgeous up there. Well, that's great. Well, thank you for listening, and stay warm and dry.
We will do our best. I have a question regarding the iPad. I'm an educator, and okay. I've been considering a possibility for an application for the iPad, but it requires the extraction from the iPad of maybe 20 to 30 minutes of recorded material so that it can be passed on to another educator. Wow. And I've been looking and trying to figure out how to do that on the internet, and all I can gather is that there's no way to do that unless you, through an email or wirelessly in some way. Is there any way to do that?
Absolutely. It just depends on the application. Are you writing an application, or are you going to use a canned application?
I'm considering having an application written. It's kind of a specialty application.
Yeah, you can. It's not a problem. In fact, when you hook your iPad up to iTunes, go to the application tab on your iPad, and you'll notice at the bottom of the screen, there's a list of applications that can get data, that you can sync data with. A typical one would be, say, GoodReader, which is a PDF reader. So GoodReader, if you go to iTunes and you look at it, you can copy files to iTunes and from the iPad. And when you copy it into the iTunes there, it will sync it up to the iPad.
Okay, but the question is once I've gotten it off the iPad, what I want to do is then transfer it onto a CD and then pass it on to another
editor. That's no problem. You just make sure that the program you're using records it in a format that you can read on the PC. Which could be MP3 or more likely WAV. Of course, if it's half an hour, you're going to run into space issues after a while. But most iPads have plenty of space for that.
Okay.
So the key is that the application has to support it. In other words, Apple doesn't. The iPad, in order to make it easy to use, doesn't have a file system in the way that we understand a computer to have a file system. You can't just look at what files. There's no folders. I mean, there is, but it's not exposed to the user. So Apple requires an application to handle that for the user. Otherwise, you notice when you use Pages, the word processor, and you save it, Pages has a gallery of documents, but it doesn't show up anywhere. You know, there's no desktop, there's no folders. It doesn't show up anywhere else, only inside Pages. And you can export it by emailing it or by using iTunes to sync it. The idea is to make it easier for users.
Yeah.
But easier for users means harder for developers.
Yeah.
You just have to put a little extra work into it. Anybody who's writing an iPad app will know how to do this easily.
Okay. All right.
And if it records in a WAV file format, a standard audio format of any kind, MP3, WAV, I can think of a number of them, AIFF is a kind of standard Apple format, then once you get it to the PC, iTunes or other programs can then burn it to a CD. Shouldn't be any trouble. There's programs out there, I've used them, that do record and then let you export. If it's just audio you want to record, there's a number of actually really kind of cool note-taking apps for the iPad. Let me see if I can. I'm looking at my iPad right now. That will, and I use this all the time for meetings, that will record the audio of the meeting, let you take notes, keep track of what the audio was as you take notes so that you can click on a note and jump to that part of the audio, which is pretty cool, actually. Pretty useful. And some of those apps don't let you export the audio. Some of them will let you save it out and then use it in other programs. It actually makes the iPad a very, I think, Notability. Yeah, there it is. Notability is one of them. Makes the iPad very usable for note-taking. I'm typing along with my notes. I've got the audio mashed up with it. And if I want to jump to any part of the audio, I just click that part of the notes. Many apps will also have other ways to export. As somebody in the chat room is mentioning, a lot of apps will sync with Dropbox. Plain text does that, Elements as text editors. Some apps will allow you to email data. There's lots of different ways to do that. Don in Santa Monica, California, you're next. Hey, Don, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yo.
Hey, Don.
You're friend in Running Springs getting snow, but we're getting heavy rain here, and I'm on back, and I'm getting an audio break up a little bit, so I hope you can hear my question okay.
You actually sound great.
Okay. I have a friend in Boise, Idaho. I'm trying to help him set up Skype so we can communicate. I'm on a PC. He's on a Mac. Is that a
okay
between the two?
Not at all. It's one of the great things about Skype is it's completely cross-platform.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what your friend is using, you'll be able to call him.
Pardon?
Doesn't matter what your friend's using, you'll be able to call him. He'll be able to, if he has a camera on his computer, you'll be able to see him. If you have a camera on yours, he'll be able to see you.
Yeah.
We use it all the time. We love it. And I don't even know sometimes what kind of computer the...
The problem he's having is he downloads Skype, but it asks him, what program do you want to use to open up Skype? And he doesn't know what to get Skype.
He's got a bad download.
Ah, just keep trying to download it.
Well, either he got a bad download or he's not downloading it from Skype. So make sure he goes to skype.com. It's free.
But I told him. I told him to
do that. Now, it sometimes happens on a Mac. There is, in fact, a program that opens these DMG files, and they can get, the program itself can be damaged or the DMG could be damaged, and then you get that error. I don't know what to do with this, but that's not normal.
Yeah. I Skype my brother in Australia. We talk fine. I talk to my friend in New Mexico. Never had a problem, but this is the first time we've had a problem.
Yeah, it's he may have the wrong version. Make sure he gets the Mac version.
The current version?
The Mac version. You know, if he accidentally gets the Windows version, that's going to be a problem. He won't be able to open it, no.
Yeah, he did. I told him, make sure he gets the Skype for Mac.
Okay. Now, Skype's pretty good about that. When you go there on a Mac, it automatically pulls you to the right page. It knows you're on a Mac.
Yeah, okay.
So it's, you know, there is a larger problem he could have with, program on his system, but that's going to... That's a little more complicated to fix. Something you probably want to tell him that he needs to go into an Apple store and get fixed. But I don't think that's what's going on. I think he's not getting the right file.
Well, persistent. We'll keep going. And if it doesn't work, I'll tell him to go to
the
store and have it.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Exactly.
Enjoy your trip.
Thanks for calling. I can't wait. I'm excited. Pam in, let's see. Do I have time? Yes, I do. Pam in San Bernardino. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Very well. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I've been listening to you since day one on KFI.
2004, January 3rd, a day that will live in infamy.
When I didn't have computers, I at least was able to stay on top of what was going on in the world, thanks to you.
That's good. I got to use that in my advertising.
Well, you know, we got to. Nowadays, I'm an old secretary that was happy with my typewriter, but now I got to have a computer.
Times change. That's right. Yeah.
But my question is actually for the benefit of my 30-year-old Asperger's son.
Okay.
He's a Nintendo man, a Wii gamer that don't even talk to him about anything but that. Doesn't even watch television. He does his Wii on...
What's his game?
Oh, God, you name it. Anything.
That's so cute.
I don't know.
That's
I kind of say the game. That's your world. That's not mine. You know. You
well, guys... I have to tell you there that, of course, Asperger's has a wide range, but there are a lot of people in the computer industry who are mildly Asperger's. It's very common.
Well, his was pretty intense. We've had a lot of neuro problems since he was a little boy, you know, a little boy kind of thing. But now, and I couldn't get him to deal with people in the world, but he sure does deal with them on his Wii.
Well, and that's right. And I think that's why people with Asperger's often do very well. Hang on the line. We're going to talk to you in a minute, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. He is Chris Marquardt. He's the photo guy. He joins us every week to talk about photography. His podcast is called Tips from the Top Floor. You can subscribe to that at tfttf.com. Actually, go to chrismarquardt.com. That's got everything Chris does. Marquardt. And he's coming to town, coming to the U.S. When are your workshops?
I am going to hold several workshops in the U.S. this year. Actually, in summer, I'll be over in August. One in Washington, D.C. We'll be shooting in Washington. That's my first time to Washington. I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful city. You're going to really love that.
It's also going to have a pretty strong component about post-processing. So, I call it the digital backlog. When people end up having so many pictures that they didn't work on.
Tell me about it.
I get emails from people telling me that they stop taking pictures. They don't take their camera with them because they have several thousand pictures waiting for them.
Right.
And it's this wall somewhere there that you don't want to climb. So
yep.
That workshop in Washington is going to have a pretty strong component about fighting that, making sure you can plow through a lot of pictures in a very short time.
Very cool. Now, if you want to know more about Chris's workshops, you go to
discoverthetopfloor.com. That's the best place to find
discoverthetopfloor.com. Yep. So what would you like to talk about this week, Mr. Marquardt?
There's so much gadget talk on this show. I thought I'll take it to a different direction again. Talk a bit about something more creative. So the main question is what
more creative than gadgets?
Yep.
Okay. Well, no, you're right, because I think especially with photography, it becomes very much about the hardware, and wrongly so. You know, people and photographers are always a great pain to say it's the photographer, not the camera. Well,
that's it.
Tell me, this is my adage, my thinking about all of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the truth is that, of course, you have to use a technology to capture an image, whether it's an Instamatic, a Brownie, or a Canon 5D Mark II. You've got to have something. And part of the photographer's job is understanding how to use that equipment well so that you can get the images that you want to get. But ultimately, the thing that's most important is your eye. There's a couple of things you need to do. You need to have a composition in mind, whether you're telling, and we talk about this a lot on the show, whether you're telling a story or you're drawing the eye to a point of the picture. And then once you've composed it, your job is to expose it properly. And that's where the camera comes in, and knowing how to use a camera so you get the right exposure.
Well, today's cameras can do a tremendous job. I'm actually pretty happy with what most digital cameras can do.
The automatic is good.
They do a pretty good job. Yeah. But apart from that, a good exposure doesn't really make the picture. Let's look at a few things that help make a good picture. What's your definition for a good picture?
Well, that's interesting. I asked Bruce Dale that once. He's a National Geographic photographer for many years, one of my favorite photographers of all time. And he says, I look at it and I get a feeling in my gut. I just know. Because I asked him, this is that issue you were talking about. I take a lot of pictures. A lot of pictures. And I want to know what to throw out. And I don't want to spend a lot of time agonizing about it. So he said, look for that feeling. You'll know in your gut when you see the picture.
Yep. And I thought long about this, but I think the good picture is the one that makes you come back for a second look.
Oh, I like that.
If you flip through a book with like 500 pictures, the one picture that you flip the page back to, just to take a second look, because there is something that you don't really have to be able to nail it down. But if there is something that makes you flip back, that's a good picture, right?
Yes, for sure.
It's like
any other piece of art. A good movie makes you think about it and revisit it.
Exactly.
I know it was a bad movie when I don't think another thought about it after leaving the theater.
Right. So there are a few things that I think can really help. A few very, very simple things that can help make a picture better, and usually clearer is better.
Okay.
Easier to understand. So, for example, make sure a picture has a good, clear subject.
Mm.
If the viewer looks at a picture and the viewer knows right away what that picture is about, if it's uncluttered, that usually helps. If it has a clear point of interest. Next thing is the focus. Where do you put the focus in a picture? Focus can help you tell a story in a picture by placing, that's why it's called focus, by placing focus on something in the picture. So that can help you make clear what that subject is by focusing on it. It's very, very simple. In general, the composition, I don't really think it's that important to go by something like the rule of thirds or something, but I think it's already enough if the photographer makes a deliberate decision on where to place things. If the photographer starts thinking about what they want to place in the picture, where, that is already, they're already halfway there.
Some great thoughts to Chris Marquardt's here, chrismarquardt.com. Talking photography, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We've got more in just a bit with Chris. When you listen to this show, you should be backing up. Of course, I don't have to remind you if you're a Carbonite customer, because you're always backing up. Guarantee you sometime in the next few months, maybe next year, you're going to lose data. Something bad will happen to your computer. A crash, a virus. Maybe you'll drop or lose your laptop. And in an instant, all those precious files, the music, the pictures, the financial records, the email, will be gone. Gone forever. Unless you have a backup. So before anything happens to you, remember these three words. Carbonite Online Backup. There are three reasons to get Carbonite right now. It's easy. You can get started right now at carbonite.com with the offer code Leo. It's automatic. Your pictures and the other files on your computer are backed up every time you're online, securely and effectively. And finally, Carbonite gives you anytime, anywhere access to your backed up files from any computer, even before disaster strikes. So it's almost like you've got your files available, you know, to you anywhere. They even have free smartphone apps. Try Carbonite right now before you need it, because after you need it, too late. Carbonite.com, offer code Leo for a 2-week trial. If you decide to buy, use my name again. You'll get 2 months additional free. Got to back it up to get it back. So do it right at Carbonite. All right, let's get back to Chris's photography tips. Some more ideas for getting the most out of your pictures.
What often helps a picture really shine is if it tells a story. I think that's what it boils down to as well. So tell a story. One of the easiest ways to tell a story I found is that if you let two things interact in a picture, that evokes some sort of emotion. I've seen this one picture, a very simple black and white picture of a dog standing at an edge of, like, there was a river flowing, and the dog standing there looking at a duck on the river, the duck looking at the dog. Very simple, easy, simple to understand picture. And all of a sudden you put yourself into the mindset of the dog. What is the dog thinking? What's the duck thinking?
There's a story right there.
There is a story right there. Two things that do something with each other is a very, very strong way to tell the story. Or another example, Monica, my fiance, she was actually, she loves to knit. So she was knitting, but at the same time, she had an iPad next to her with, like, the knitting pattern on it. So I took that picture with a very, well, knitting is a very analog thing, but at the same time, there was this contrast. There was this dialogue between the knitting and the iPad. That told a story right there.
Yes. Yeah.
There's another way to tell a great story, and that is to leave things out. Because actually, that is probably one of the strongest ones. If you don't tell the entire story.
How can you know that? Okay. So that, like, there should be something there, but it's missing?
Exactly. If you don't show things that people expect to be there, that'll be a story in itself. For example, I've come along a fence with, like, one of the pieces missing. All of a sudden, a story unfolds. Someone kicked it out, or a car drove against it, or whatever. There are so many ways to tell these stories by just not showing the entire thing. You open up so much room for interpretation if you don't show everything. So the good old rule to step back to make sure everything's in the picture, I would turn that on its head and say, okay, step closer, get closer, cut something off. Let something be cut off at the edge of the picture, and that will, in a way, make it more interesting. Very simple stuff.
Cut the head off.
cut part of the face off. Portraits work really well. Get really close. Cut stuff off. People will make up a story in their mind. I have this one picture of a guy in Kathmandu, and all you see is his two feet sticking out a doorway. He's probably asleep. But you don't really know that just those 2 feet, he's taking a rest, or there are, like, 100 different stories you can make up of that. You just see the feet, but.
And that raises actually a good point, which is look at a lot of other people's pictures.
Absolutely.
Because you learn what's good, what you like from how you react, and, or, you know, if you look at a book of a great photographer, you know, you should feel some reaction on every shot, but you'll learn why is that shot? What is it about that shot that makes me look again? That's a good way to learn. Chris Marquardt is, of course, a great way to learn. ChrisMarquardt.com. He's got a great program for the iPhone called Pocket Chris, which is a great learning tool.
And yep, gives you some small lessons in your pocket, like a little instructor in your pocket.
Yeah, a little instructor in your pocket. Going, woo-hoo, woo-hoo. His great workshop's coming up. Make sure you go to discoverthetopfloor.com to find out more. And we'll see you next week. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy.